This is Audible.
The Interpretation of Dreams by Professor Sigmund Freud, LLD. 4. A bit of rising ground, and on it something like a toilet in the open, a very long bench, at the end of which is a large toilet aperture. All of the back edge is thickly covered with little heaps of excrement of all sizes and degrees of freshness, a shrub behind the bench. I urinate upon the bench. A long stream of urine rinses everything clean. The patches of excrement easily come off and fall into the opening. It seems as though something remained at the end, nevertheless. Why did I experience no disgust in this dream? Because, as the analysis shows, the most pleasant and satisfying thoughts have cooperated in the formation of this dream. Upon analyzing it, I immediately think of the Augean stables cleansed by Hercules. I am this Hercules. The rising ground and the shrub belong to Ausse, where my children are now staying. I have discovered the infantile etiology of the neuroses, and have thus guarded my own children from becoming ill. The bench, omitting the aperture, of course, is the faithful copy of a piece of furniture which an affectionate female patient has made me a present of. This recalls how my patients honour me. Even the Museum of Human Excrement is susceptible of less disagreeable interpretation. However much I am disgusted with it, it is a souvenir of the beautiful land of Italy, where in little cities, as everyone knows, water closets are not equipped in any other way. The stream of urine that washes everything clean is an unmistakable allusion to greatness. It is in this manner that Gulliver extinguishes the great fire in Lilliput. To be sure, he thereby incurs the displeasure of the tiniest of queens. In this way, too, Gargantua, the Superman in Master Rabelais, takes vengeance upon the Parisians, straddling Notre Dame and training his stream of urine upon the city. Only yesterday I was turning over the leaves of Garnier's illustrations of Rabelais before I went to bed. And strangely enough, this is another proof that I am the Superman. The platform of Notre Dame was my favourite nook in Paris. Every free afternoon I was accustomed to go up into the towers of the church and climb about among the monsters and devil masks there. The circumstances that all the excrement vanishes so rapidly before the stream correspond to the motto, Afflavit et dissipati sunt, which I shall some day make the title of a chapter on the therapeutics of hysteria. And now as to the occasion giving rise to the dream. It had been a hot afternoon in summer. In the evening I had given a lecture on the relation between hysteria and the perversions, and everything which I had to say displeased me thoroughly, appeared to me stripped of all value. I was tired, found no trace of pleasure in my difficult task, and longed to get away from this rummaging in human filth, to see my children, and then the beauties of Italy. In this mood I went from the auditorium to a café, to find some modest refreshment in the open air, for my appetite had left me. But one of my audience went with me. He begged for permission to sit with me while I drank my coffee and gulped down my roll, and began to say flattering things to me. He told me how much he had learned from me, and that he now looked at everything through different eyes, that I had cleansed the Augean stables, i.e. the theory of the neuroses, of its errors and prejudices, in short, that I was a very great man. My mood was ill-suited to his song of praise. I struggled with disgust and went home earlier in order to extricate myself. Before I went to sleep, I turned over the leaves of Rabelais and read a short story by C.F. Meyer, entitled Die Leiden eines Knaben, The Hardships of a Boy. The dream had been drawn from these materials, and the novel by Meyer added the recollection of childish scenes. Cf. The Dream About Count Thun, last scene. The mood of the day, characterized by disgust and annoyance, is continued in the dream in the sense that it is permitted to furnish nearly the entire material for the dream content. But during the night, the opposite mood of vigorous and even exaggerated self-assertion was awakened and dissipated the earlier mood. The dream had to take such a form as to accommodate the expression of self-depreciation and exaggerated self-assertion in the same material. This compromise formation resulted in an ambiguous dream content, but likewise in an indifferent strain of feeling owing to the restraint of the contrasts upon each other. According to the theory of wish fulfillment, this dream could not have happened had not the suppressed, but at the same time pleasurable, train of thought concerning personal aggrandizement been coupled with the opposing thoughts of disgust. For disagreeable things are not intended to be represented by the dream. Painful thoughts that have occurred during the day can force their way into the dream only if they lend a cloak to the wish fulfillment. The dream activity can dispose of the effects of the dream thoughts in still another way, besides admitting them or reducing them to zero. It can change them into their opposite. We have already become acquainted with the rule of interpretation that every element of the dream may be interpreted by its opposite, as well as by itself. One can never tell at the outset whether to set down the one or the other. Only the connection can decide this point. A suspicion of this state of affairs has evidently got into popular consciousness. Dream books very often proceed according to the principle of contraries in their interpretation. Such transformation into opposites is made possible by the intimate concatenation of associations, which in our thoughts finds the idea of a thing in that of its opposite. Like every other displacement, this serves the purposes of the censor, but it is also often the work of the wish fulfillment, for wish fulfillment consists precisely in this substitution of an unwelcome thing by its opposite. The emotions of the dream thoughts may appear in the dream transformed into their opposites just as well as the ideas, and it is probable that this inversion of emotions is usually brought about by the dream censor. The suppression and inversion of effects are useful in social life, as the current analogy for the dream censor has shown us, above all, for purposes of dissimulation. If I converse with a person to whom I must show consideration while I am saying unpleasant things to him, it is almost more important that I should conceal the expression of my emotion from him than that I modify the wording of my thoughts. If I speak to him in polite words, but accompany them by looks or gestures of hatred and disdain, the effect which I produce upon this person is not very different from what it would have been if I had recklessly thrown my contempt upon his face. Above all, then, the censor bids me suppress my emotions, and if I am master of the art of dissimulation, I can hypocritically show the opposite emotion, smiling where I should like to be angry, and pretending affection where I should like to destroy. We already know of an excellent example of such an inversion of emotion for the purposes of the dream censor. In the dream about my uncle's beard, I feel great affection for my friend R, at the same time that, and because,